something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters. With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Today, it's great to chat with Dave Asprey, founder and chairman of Bulletproof. Dave is a three-time New York Times bestselling science author, host of the Webby award-winning podcast Bulletproof Radio, and has been featured on The Today Show, CNN, The New York Times, Dr. Oz, and more. His latest book, among many great books, is called Fast This Way, Burn Fat, Heal Inflammation, and Eat Like the High-Performing Human You Are Meant to Be. Dave, so great to chat with you today.
Scott, it's always a pleasure. I'm a big fan of your work. I've mentioned you multiple times, you know, when I talk about the four F words in Fast This Way, you know, things that drive human behavior. But there's another one, you know, around transcendence and, you know, being more connected to more than just yourself and all of that. So thanks for the inspiration.
Well, thank you. You know, the feeling's mutual. After I was on, you were gracious enough to have me on your podcast, I was left with this feeling of, you know, this is a cool cat. You know, it was such an effortless conversation we had. You know, I mean, there was no like effort there. So I love when that happens.
Yeah, that's the best podcast or conversations you want to have anyway. And you just have a few hundred thousand people listening in because they wanted to hear, and then everybody wins.
Yeah. Well, so we have a lot to talk about. I hope I got your bio right. I couldn't actually see anything on the screen. So I was doing predictive text, but I got all the words.
Everything, but now it's four times New York Times bestseller. Fastest Way just hit the list again for second week. So this is my fourth book on the list, which is,
congratulations.
I started to feel like a real author at a certain point. You're like, okay, I think I'm there.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
I really enjoyed this book, and I wanted to kind of start at the beginning, if we can, with this vision quest, because I have to be completely honest. I wasn't even familiar with the phrase vision quest, and then it took
me
down. I mean, people are shocked by that. They're like, the author of Transcend has never been on a vision quest with a shaman. But, you know, this is new territory for me. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that experience and maybe why I should try a vision quest sometime. So tell me about what it was like, you know. Why did you look into it? I mean, you just were spontaneous. You went on to Google and you typed, like, you just went to the first shaman that showed up. I mean, I couldn't even imagine that having a high probability of turning out well.
In retrospect, the appropriate way to find a shaman who's a good fit for you is to ask around and to get a personal referral, right? And I have been through Alberto Viodo's shamanic training, at least the beginning of his training program. And I did that after. Certainly after I did ayahuasca, and I believe after I did the work in the cave. No, I did it before I did the work in the cave. What it comes down to is, in some traditional cultures in North America, but not all of them, from what I understand, there are various rituals. And as a coming of age, or when there was a big change in your life, you would basically go out with a loincloth and a knife or whatever the traditional minimal garb was. And you would live in the wilderness fasting until you had a vision, right? And you'd come back with your vision. And quite often this was done for young men when they'd get to, you know, age of adolescence, kind of to celebrate adulthood, and at various other special times in your life. And if you're more on the medicinal side of things, more on the spiritual side of things, you might do regular fasts in solitude. And it's a long-standing tradition, not even just in North America. You know, I have an encyclopedia of shamanism around here somewhere that looks at these practices around the world. So there's a long history of doing this. And I don't think it's fair for any one culture to say that they own fasting, because, you know, the people in India and the people in China, like, it's a global thing. In fact, one of the guests on the show, Dan Brown, who I believe is at Harvard, he's translated the 13th century text direct from Sanskrit.
Mystery writer.
No, he has the same name as the mystery writer. This is a really experienced either psychology or psychiatry professor who also knows Sanskrit and translates 13th century cave yoga texts about how to do breathing and fasting in caves. So, like, this goes way back, and it's a universal thing. And in my case, in 2008, you know, given I didn't quite yet know how to properly work with the spiritual side of things the way I know now, I just connected through serendipity with someone who could take me out. And it was interesting, to say the least, because I didn't know what to expect. And when you go on a spiritual path and do some kind of transformative thing, and it can be anything transcendent, right? You get an idea, and it kind of sits in the back of your mind, and it percolates, and eventually you feel called to do it. Same thing happened when I went to Mount Kailash in the very remote part of Western Tibet, which is kind of the Mount Olympus of the East, you know, where the gods live. If you're Hindu or Buddhist, this is, you know, the home of them, and no one ever would climb the mountain, but you walk in a circle around it to show respect. So I heard about this, it sat with me for 10 years, and the opportunity presented itself when I was in Nepal, and I'm like, all right, I'm on a bus to Lhasa. It just happens, right? So this was one of those situations where I just felt like, you know, I don't know why I need to do this, but I knew part of it was I had issues with just being afraid of being alone. And a lot of people have this. Mm-hmm. And what I learned through my personal development process of just becoming who I am is that fear is never a rational thing. Fear isn't a thought. It's a feeling. And so feelings don't have to have any reason for them. But this is something that will drive people to be in bad relationships longer than they should. It'll drive them to stay in a job that's bad for them. It'll drive them, you know, to not look inward, because as long as there's someone else around, you can look there. So I thought, all right, I know I have residual stuff around that. I also know I eat when I'm lonely, and I'm afraid of fasting. Like, I know that if I fast, I'm gonna act like a jerk, and I've been 300 pounds. I don't want to do that. So I'm like, okay, this is great. 4 days in a cave. There's a spiritual aspect to it. I'm going to push my loneliness fear. I'm going to push my hunger fear, but there's no people, there's no food, so there's no temptation. And let me see what happens. And that was why I did it.
That was brave.
It was also my first 4-day fast.
It was your first 4-day fast. I mean, to just jump into the deep end like that, you know, must have taken some courage there. So when you emerged from this cave, what insights did you have then about how revolutionary fasting can be?
The thing that just blew my mind, okay, I was of the mindset, and this was before I wrote the Bulletproof Diet, and I've been teaching people intermittent fast for more than 10 years. People lost 1 million+ pounds on the stuff that I do in my books. But I didn't know any of that. And so for me, I was thinking, I'm going to be so weak, like, you know, I'm going to get picked up at the end of this and I'll probably just be a zombie. On the fourth day, when it was time to get picked up, during the fast, you have a cell phone, but not a smartphone. And in the morning you wake up, you send a text that's basically, I'm not dead. And then you get a text, thumbs up, and then you turn off the phone and, you know, you're all by yourself. Mm. But what happened is I got a text, you know, I'll be at the trailhead at noon or whatever. And I'm like, you know what? I'll just walk to this other cave where I know there's another person. I'm feeling so good. So I poured out most of my water. I kept a canteen, threw my sleeping bag, my jacket, my backpack. And I was just like glowing with energy, way more than I'd had in a long time. And I ended up getting lost in the desert, and I climbed the wrong mountain.
Well, no.
That's and my phone's getting low on battery, and it's getting in the sun starting to set. And I'm like, you know, I grew up in the desert. I know survival and mountaineering and all.
You have water on you?
It's not going to be pretty. I had one canteen full of water. Who wants to carry 3 gallons of water with you, right? But it was, I didn't have a concern in the world. I'm like, things are fine. And I was so full of energy. I could have walked a marathon. I ended up walking about 10 miles with no food for 4 days. And I wasn't sore, wasn't tired. I just felt great the whole time. And, you know, right as my battery was almost dead, of course, I just found my way to the right road and, you know, found a road and found the truck and everything was good. But the fact that I could walk around feeling fantastic, just enjoying the sky and looking at all the cactus and the snakes and just the creatures of the desert, not a care in the world without any food. Like, are you kidding? That was completely transformative because I realized, you know, that feeling that you have, that's if I don't eat, I'm going to die. It takes you 3 months to starve to death, maybe 2 months, depending on your metabolism. So if you skip lunch or skip breakfast, you're not starving. You're not even in the world of starving. But that's what your body believes. That's what your body makes you feel. And then you act on it. Mm. That helped me to see that. It was one of the reasons that I felt really comfortable with intermittent fasting, is one of the very early people talking about this as a thing you can do. And that was, you know, a big inspiration for the beginnings of the Bulletproof diet.
Now, why did you start Bulletproof? What did you feel like it was missing in the market at that time?
Wow.
That's a big question. I know.
In order to lose the 100 pounds that I've lost and I've kept off for a long time, I struggled. I mean, I was a raw vegan. I did liquid diets of various types, even going back into the 80s. I'm talking like I'm 16 and trying a liquid diet because I'm fat and look, I can lose 20 pounds in a week and you gain 30 2 weeks later. Yeah. And these aren't eating disorder kind of things. These are a sincere desire to lose, you know, 50 or 100 pounds that need to go. I tried Atkins and I lost 50 of the 100 pounds, which is an early form of keto. And it took me 10 more years and thousands of papers and just deciding to take control of my own biology to get the other 50 pounds to stay off. And I looked at every diet book out there and all of them focused on just one thing. I'm like, guys, no. So I wrote the Bulletproof Diet because this is a diet that accounts for things that have become major trends. It had intermittent fasting. It had keto, that's cyclical. It had don't eat omega-6 seed oils, instead eat grass-fed animals and things like that. It had avoid plant toxins like lectins that are causing inflammation for you. Mm. And of course, you know, don't eat sugar. So it had 5 things that have basically become more and more trendy over the last 10 years, all in one book, because you have to do them all if you want the maximum human performance. But that's why I wrote the book. I started the blog because I've run an anti-aging nonprofit group in Palo Alto in Silicon Valley. And I did it for more than 10 years. I was the only guy under 50 in the room. And I'm learning so much precious knowledge from my elders. And we're 4 minutes from Google's headquarters. And no one from Google ever shows up. I'm like, but don't they understand? This is the stuff that makes your brain work better. This stuff that makes you stay young. Like, this is so precious. And I realized the problem was the language. So I sat down with my board and I said, guys, we should start sharing this in a blog and we do some video and all this stuff. And they argued for 3 months over the name of the blog. And I was like, you know what? It's okay. This doesn't have to be nonprofit. It's just going to be my blog. So I started writing all of this knowledge accumulated from more than a decade of intense self-experimentation and research. Like, I'm just going to put it out there. 5 people will read the blog. And when they read the blog, it's going to help them not suffer the way I suffered. I spent hundreds of thousands of dollars recovering my health and becoming as healthy as I am now. Actually, a lot of that on the upgrades, it's more than $1 million. But a lot of that I didn't need to do. I didn't need to suffer for a decade. I didn't need to do all that. I just needed clear guidance. So I put it down. I know it's going to help a few people. And it turns out more than a few people are interested. And it took off with like developers and entrepreneurs in Silicon Valley, then Wall Street. And from there, it went to Hollywood and the recording industry. Because these are all people with high mental demand who they want to look a certain way. They want to feel a certain way. But this was how people learned their brains to work. And sure, they want to look good, but they want their brains to work. Because who cares if you look good if you can't remember your lines, right? Mm-hmm. And the entrepreneurs always have more work to do. And if you're sitting in a meeting and you're a zombie, it's a dead meeting and you know it. I lived that way growing my career in Silicon Valley and I was faking it. And there are a lot of people faking it right now. I'm like, I just want to sincerely not let people do that. I had a VP level job at a public company with stock options when I started Bulletproof. It was not meant to be a business. When I decided to make coffee and MCT oil, but especially coffee that didn't have toxins in it, so I could find coffee that wouldn't give me a headache and make me want to punch people. Like, maybe 100 people care. The market size for clean coffee was zero, and it's a $100 million category. Mm-hmm. The market size for MCT was nothing. It's a $1 billion category. For collagen protein, $1 billion category. And I did all three of those because you couldn't buy it. And like, that was it. Just make stuff you can't buy.
Are you the one that like made MCT like the thing to buy? Like,
yep. That was me.
Like, I never heard, there was a point where I never heard about it before. And then there's a point where I heard about it all the time. Yep. Okay.
Lots of companies, you know, knock it off. And there's some subtle chemistry involved in making it in the right way. But yeah, I made MCT the thing.
Dave, I did some this morning and I'm too jacked up. What do you recommend for it? I usually love it, but today I think I drank too much of your coffee. My heart is pounding.
There's no such thing as too much of my coffee. The cure is another cup, Scott.
Is that so? You could go off the cliff and then return back to normal?
No, I'm totally messing with you. Don't do that. Do not.
By the way, I'm not blaming your. I mean, I'm not blaming your coffee. I'm saying that's my own fault for drinking. I was so excited to talk to you today. I was so excited to talk to you today that I was like, I'm going to wear the glasses. I'm going to have like five cups of MCT, you know, of your coffee.
You didn't have five full cups of Bulletproof, did you?
Yeah, but I had a couple. And then, both of them, I had MCT, and then you gave me butter as well. You gave me all these things to put it. I put it all in. I put it all in. Yeah.
Why am I so? A double dose of it.
Yeah. Like, why is my heart like wanting to beat out of its chest right now?
That's just caffeine.
Okay.
You got overcaffeinated. And that's a simple thing. What happens with MCT is your body, especially if you haven't done a keto diet or any intermittent fasting ever before, your body is like, oh, thank God. I finally got the ability to make more electrons in my mitochondria, and your neurons light up. The same way I felt on that fourth day of fasting, I was running all in ketones. That was part of the reason I was so energetic. Yeah. You get that when you drink Bulletproof coffee because the MCT, the specific kind that's in there, turns into ketones very efficiently in the body. And so all of a sudden your neurons have more electrons than they did before. So now you've got too much caffeine and your neurons are like, yeah, I got the energy, right? And that combination is pretty potent.
Yeah, so I'd say. I'm like, give me a marathon.
Yeah. If you get too much caffeine like that, there's something called L-theanine. It's an amino acid that helps you chill out.
I do have, I should have taken that. I have some right.
Yeah, take like 300 milligrams of that. It'll smooth things out.
I see it on my desk. But anyway, okay. So your story is very interesting. I mean, you said once to like on a Lewis Howes interview that like you had more estrogen than your mom or something.
And when I was 26,
and then less testosterone than her. And that was, you know, you had health. The point here is I'm not like knocking people with low testosterone, but the point here is that you had certain health situation condition that I didn't know till later.
Chronic fatigue syndrome, like fibromyalgia, like every Lyme disease, every bad thing, toxic mold poison, everything bad.
You
thing
had a lot of things.
I had it.
Yeah.
Arthritis, a high risk of stroke and heart attack, prediabetes. It was all in there before I was 30.
Yeah.
And by the way, it's okay to knock people who are low on testosterone. Guys and women, if you're low on testosterone and you know it in a lab test, you can fix it. You either change your sleep and change your saturated fat intake. And if that doesn't work, you can use external bioidentical testosterone the way I do, and it'll change your brain and it'll change your life. It'll give you your zest for life back, right? And there's no, it's just like taking a thyroid hormone or anything else. If you're low and your body's not making it, you can take control of your biology and you will love your life when you do it. And it has side effects where, oh yeah, you might like your bedroom activities better, but that's not why you do it. You do it because it makes you like you.
Well, I find like, I'm really into weightlifting and I find that just naturally increases my testosterone.
Heavy lifting will do it.
But you know, there's like an insult that's going around though. Like they call people like soy boys or whatever. Like I don't like that. You know, I don't like insulting people.
Insulting people is rude and it's unnecessary and it means you're insecure in your belief system. Yeah. And I'm just curious about my belief system. You know, if I'm wrong about something, I like to see the evidence and, you know, I'll test it. What I recommend to people has been extensively tested and it's directionally very accurate and it's to the test of time. But hey, I'm sure there's some tweaks I could do. You know, maybe I need to take my glasses off at some point. Of course, I created the company and wrote the patents on why they work. So I'm pretty sure they work, but you show me they don't and I'll change my behavior and it's okay. Right.
Yeah. So you're right. So you say something really interesting in your book. You say going without doesn't mean going without everything. And well, this is a common theme. I feel like you talk about that throughout this book, you know, like, you can still try this fast, or you have this like rule, right? Like a certain amount of days and a certain, can you tell us this rule that you, that, that you talk about in your book? And so people can get like started on the right foot.
Sure. The definition of fasting is to go without. And what fasting is, it's to show the body that it's not going to die when you don't get something that you feel like you need. And for me, I felt like I needed to be around people all the time, or I would get stressed, right? That was my body thinking that I was going to die if I didn't have something around all the time. It was not a true thing, but it's a thing that felt true. And you feel like if you don't have lunch, you're starving. In fact, you probably say it like that. I'm starving. Let's go eat. Well, you're not actually starving. It just feels like that. That's because you're having hunger cravings because you haven't learned how to eat the right stuff, or you haven't learned how to fast. And you can fast from masturbation. You can fast from alcohol. You can fast from carbs. It's called a keto diet. You can fast from animal products. It's called making yourself sick with a vegan diet. I mean, you can do all of these things. But fasting is simply saying, I think I need this. I'm going to show myself that I don't for some period of time. You can fast from air. It's called breath work. I'm going to breathe out and hold my lungs empty for 10 whole seconds. The first time you do that, it's going to feel really anxious. And eventually you're like, you know what? I can own this. I know that at a certain point, air is the right thing, but your anxiety goes down. Every time you fast from something you think you need, it creates more free energy for the rest of your life once you show yourself that you didn't need it as bad as you thought you did. And even with the people who are really rigid, you can only have water during a fast. I'm like, I don't know, guys. I know some people who think you can't even have water. They think you should have fasting without water. So which one is the real fast? Mm. And the reality is, let's look at the biochemistry of fasting. So whenever you go 12 hours without food, you've done a little miniature fast. And a lot of people do that without knowing it. And there's evidence that says benefits start to kick in. But if you do 14 or 16 or 18 hours without food, you get a lot more benefits, but you don't have to do it every day. And you might find that it works better every day. But a lot of people say, well, I felt really good on a 14-hour fast, so I started doing 18-hour fasts. And then I did them every day. And then once a week, I would just only eat once a day, so I was doing a 23-hour fast. And then every weekend, I fast 2 days. And if it works for you, that's great. But for a lot of people, they, because it worked at first, they keep doing it more and more and more, and it's over fasting. And it creates a lot of biological stress. And I see women messing with their hormones, first sleep, then hormones, then thinning hair. And with men, it's sleep. Then it's a different hormone, but you basically wake up without a kickstand and then you get thinning hair, and it's over fasting. So just because some is good doesn't mean more is better. So it's like a comfortable kind of fasting. And there is a working fast and there's a spiritual fast. And we talked about the spiritual fast, and there's some cool things that happen there. But in fact, I'll talk a bit more about the spiritual side in a minute, but a working fast. Okay. You've got two kids running around the house, maybe. I do, right? And they're not at school like you'd want them to be. You're trying to focus on this meeting. You're trying to get something done, and you've never fasted before, and you had a glass of water for breakfast. What's going to happen is you're going to get hangry, and you're going to be cold, and you're probably going to get shaky from hypoglycemia. You're going to feel like crap. You're not going to show up in your life. So you're not going to fast again because it's too miserable. Well, there are hacks for fasts that allow you to get the metabolic benefits of fasting, so your metabolism becomes stronger and more flexible, and you're not even thinking about food. And when you do that, you develop a fasting practice, and you do that for a few months. And, oh, I guess I could have just water, but I'll probably have black coffee. And, oh, tomorrow I was tired. Maybe I'll make it a bulletproof. But the science about what's happening in the body, we understand it now in a way we didn't 10 years ago. And you maintain this amazing system called autophagy, where your body, instead of digesting food, it digests old cells that are zombie cells or cells that are weak. Think of it if you have like one of those old Las Vegas billboards. A couple bulbs are dim. Well, you'd want to replace the dim ones. When you stop eating all the time, your body has the digestive energy to digest the weak bulbs and grow new strong ones. And it's a really powerful thing because you're not going to get diabetes if you skip breakfast most mornings. And let's think. Return on investment. I spent no money, no time, no energy on breakfast. I felt better that morning than when I ate, and then I didn't get diabetes. Like, I got paid up front, and I got returns that day, and I got returns next year. It's a fantastic thing to do.
It sounds amazing. It sounds amazing. The million, billion dollar question is how can you when you feel that urge, you know, because you distinguish between hunger and craving. And that was actually really, I mean, that was really important. It was like, huh, you know, like I'm not going to die, you know, when I have this craving, you know, like if I don't satisfy it. Right. And I can train myself to overcome it in many different areas of my life, like you talk about, you know, like, you know, we meditate, you say, because we're fasting from thinking. I like that phrasing. Right. I like that. You know, there's various things we do to train us, to give us the muscle to be able to not be ruled. Isn't it? Doesn't all this just come down to not being a slave to our cravings, you know, in a way?
I think it comes down to not being a slave to your mitochondria. These are ancient bacteria. They're embedded in every cell in your body. They sense the world about a quarter second before you become aware of it. And they make decisions. They make neurotransmitters, they make hormones, and they make energy. And they believe that you are a walking petri dish, and they do not care that you're in there. Right? You're an unwelcome guest. Their job is to keep the meat alive and make sure you reproduce. So they follow the rules that every life form does. If it's scary, take all energy, put it there, run away from, kill or hide. And then if you have more energy, use it to eat everything, which is why we eat everything. And if you have energy left after that, have sex with everything else, because that's what all life does, right? And pretty much that's everything everyone's ever done that they're ashamed of comes from one of those three things. And they're all driven by ancient code written in bacteria. And that means when you get that sensation of, oh my God, I have to eat, it's, you know, quadrillion ancient bacteria going, you should eat, right? And why they're telling you that, maybe it's because your blood sugar is dysregulated. Maybe it's because you ate something in your last meal that caused a perturbation in the system. And they're saying, you got to have more energy right now. And so a craving is an intense desire to eat. I didn't know that you could feel hungry because I thought cravings were hunger. And like, oh, I'm feeling hungry, man. I really want some food. I can wait 15 minutes, but I got to eat really soon. That's a craving. What hunger is, you know what? My energy levels are getting a little bit low. I probably would be better off if I ate in the next couple hours, but I could wait a day. Hunger is a gentle thing and it's not a scary thing, but cravings are intense. And people eat a lot of things that cause cravings. And what you find from fasting is if you wake up in the morning, like, man, my stomach's growling. I have this gnawing hunger and I just woke up. Well, it's what you ate for dinner. That's what did it. Mm-hmm. And so the meal before the fast causes cravings. And I talk in Fast This Way. I'm like, okay, here's the five big classes of things that you can eat that cause cravings. It might not cause cravings for you, but it probably does. So why don't you not eat any of those in your next meal and then see how easy your fast is? And then have some of those in the meal after that and see how easy your fast is. And I've led about 30,000 people through a fasting challenge where I teach them how to do this for free. Just if you read the book, if you don't read the book, fastthisway.com. It's a free course where I'm teaching the book to people. Mm-hmm. And the whole point there is, and people can sign up for it, like it's a gift. I want this knowledge out there. And what you find is, wow, you know, some days are really intense hunger and some days aren't. And it's totally, totally up to you. And then you realize, I don't want to eat that anymore because it's not compatible with me because it makes me starving. And if you eat food that makes you hungrier, the food didn't work.
That's really, I mean, that's profound. does that mean everything? Does that apply to everything in my life? Everything?
In terms of cravings or?
Yeah, like that principle, you know, of like, does that apply to relationships, you know, to attraction to people?
I don't think it does to relationships and attraction. I mean, you've studied that extensively. With relationships, though, that basic mitochondrial thing, look, your body is actively sensing in ways you don't know, like pheromones. Mm. And, you know, there's studies, I've talked about them on Bulletproof Radio, where men will smell good to a woman and then he's attractive. But if there's a phenotype mismatch, the guy won't smell right. But if the woman's on birth control pills that modify hormones, she can't smell the guy. And there's actually divorces that have happened because the woman goes off the pill. And her, all of a sudden she's like, my husband doesn't smell good anymore. Like, I'm not attracted at all. Ugh. And then, you know, that's a big part of it where the physical attraction.
This is why OkCupid should have like scratch and sniff option.
I've said that for years.
Do you know what I'm saying?
Time, right?
Are we on the same wavelength again? Are we in the same wavelength?
Mind meld.
Yeah. There needs to be a scratch and sniff option. No, you're absolutely right. But okay, I'll focus on the principles in your book for a second because you know there's so many diets out there, and I was reading going through your book, I was like, well, I wonder what he thinks of like the keto diet. You know, like what do you think? You know, so I would like to just hone in on that because I tried the keto diet and it made me hangry. It really did. And can you explain to me the science of this? Why it made
I'll
me
explain
hangry?
Exactly why?
Yay!
So. The Bulletproof Diet was one of the first modern keto books. But it said, use keto as a scalpel, as a tool, and use it selectively and don't stay in ketosis for long periods of time. Use MCT oil when you want to get some ketones that have a lot of benefit. Some days go for 3, 4, 5 days without eating carbs, but then eat some carbs. And the keto diet kind of devolved to, if it's not a carb, you could eat it. And, you know, the kind of the keto bro mindset.
Yeah. And carbs are
that's
evil.
What happened. And then you get companies like, oh, well, I'm going to make a coffee with milk protein isolate, which is a garbage protein. That's like a waste product. We can't even get rid of it. But they put it in there and go, well, it's keto. It didn't have any sugar. And you're like, guys, you put canola oil in there. You put like garbage proteins that cause cravings. In fact, some milk proteins break down, and I talk about it in the book, into something that sticks to the opiate receptors in the brain. You're going to want more of that the next day? Yeah. Gluten does that as well. It's called gluteomorphin, right? And this is why you have a piece of bread. You're going to want one the next day and the next day and the next day. And so you just realize some foods are craving masters and some of them aren't. And what you find is eating the right kinds of fat and more fat is incredibly satisfying, but eating the wrong kinds of fat makes you hungrier and makes you more inflamed. And so you're like, wow, who would have thought? It's not about how much fat or how many calories. It's about the right kind of fat and the right kind of protein. So when you eat keto, you were probably eating artificial sweeteners.
Yeah.
You were probably eating low quality, cheap proteins. They put in, keto mass gainer 5,000 and all the products like that, because you can say keto on anything that's sugar free, but you should be on a moderate protein, high, healthy fat keto, and magic happens. You felt like garbage all the time, in part because if you lost weight, your gut bacteria got really stressed. They pumped out lipopolysaccharide, which caused brain fog. And I talk about how to hack that in the book. There's a couple of supplements that completely eliminate that. And if you're losing weight, your fat cells are full of mercury and pesticides. Your body actually stores it there. And so if you're losing weight and you're not binding the toxins as you lose weight, you get brain fog from it. When people do the stuff that I've been teaching for a while, which is eating the right foods to be in ketosis for brief periods of time, they don't get the keto flu.
Well, I wish I knew you a couple of years ago when I tried this diet. I said earlier there's something really profound about it, and I couldn't pinpoint it. And I think I can go deeper at a much nerdier level about why I think this is really profound. It relates to, I think, notions of free will in a way. Roy Baumeister wrote a paper that I'd love to send to you after this call. On the title of it is "Do Smokers Have Free Will?" And they did a large review of the literature amongst those who were addicted to smoking and those who were able to quit, to actually just try to ask the question like, just how much are we a slave to those kinds of impulses when we're addicted to smoking? And they found that people overestimated the extent to which they would never be able to quit. They overestimate, they kind of, in the moment when they were addicted, they said, there's no way in the world I could ever not be addicted to smoking. I'll die if I don't smoke for 2-3 days.
Yep.
But, he found that that people were, like 90% of his sample were shocked. Like a week went by, 2-3 weeks by, eventually they're like, oh, I'm not even thinking about smoking anymore. It's just something I'm not even thinking about. So you just made me think of that literature, because I just wonder if there's like a mind-bogglingly profound truth of the world here, which is that we need to just really not listen so much to our cravings about anything, in a way. Like, we need to not take them so seriously. Like, they're telling us that we're going to just die if we don't. Like, oh, you need to watch that porn movie. You're going to die. It's like, no, I'm not going to die if I don't want.
Yeah. Here's where that feeling comes from. And I talk about fasting from porn in here.
Yeah, I know.
So there's a quadrillion ancient bacteria, and they form a distributed intelligence.
Yeah.
And really complex behaviors emerge when you run simple rules unfathomable numbers of times. And we've proven this mathematically. It's like a new branch of math around emergent behaviors. And so what's happening is these little guys who get to see things and make decisions before it rolls up through your peripheral cortex and you even get to pay attention to it. And they're going, if we don't reproduce the species, it's a bad thing. And every guy who's ever been in bed having sex going, I am not going to ejaculate right now. All of a sudden, right before it happens, you're like, you know what? It's a really good idea that right now, the most important thing on planet, I'm going to do it. And just 5 seconds ago, you're like, I'm not going to. Who flipped that switch?
Yeah.
It's your mitochondria. It's the same guy who, when you leaned on a hot stove and you didn't know it and you pulled your hand away and go, good thing I pulled my hand away, even though you didn't pull your hand away, it was automatic. It was that guy.
Yeah.
They're in charge, right? And they really want to make sure the species reproduces. They really want to make sure a famine doesn't kill you, because you might be the last human on Earth and it would be the end of the species. So you're going to eat the goddamn chips. And that's how it is, right? And if that thing might be scary, it doesn't matter if you know it's just your boss telling you you did a crappy job, but it feels like death. So you're going to run away, kill, or hide. And you're going to yell at your boss. You're going to go home and mope or do whatever your coping behavior is until you do your personal work. So the whole process of personal development is training the mitochondrial distributed intelligence to sit, roll over, beg, and behave itself. Everything you do. And the reason it's so sneaky is it can hide things from you. Yeah. And also it can turn down the energy. And willpower comes from electrons. And I have the studies to prove that. They're in, I think, in Super, no, they're in Headstrong, my book, where there's actually like studies done. Willpower goes down when the amount of free electricity in the body goes down. So these little guys are like, we can pull every trick in the book and we get to do it before you have permission. So of course it's hard to do it. But when you're like, guys, you're going to sit with that popcorn on your nose the way the dog does before he's allowed to eat it, because I'm not eating until 2 o'clock this afternoon. And you can do it with willpower and just muscle through it. And it's a spiritual fast. Or you could say, tell you what, I'm going to give you an alternate fuel that will cause you to become stronger. So you'll stop pestering me about food. Either one works.
I love this. Can we get more into like the kind of mentality we can develop to sustain this food related lifestyle? Like, let's say I want to wake up tomorrow morning and be like, I'm a new man. I'm living the fastest way lifestyle. What are other things in my armor, my mental armor, that I can do?
Well, one of the things is just to ask yourself, is this true? And the is this true question is like, okay, I feel like I'm starving. I know it's not true, right? And that's actually from Byron Katie is the one who's done the most work on that. And most of the urges and cravings that you have around food are completely not true. And then you learn to ask yourself a question, is this biologically compatible with me? And there's a part of you, this is your mitochondria, says, but it's flavorful and delicious and I want to eat it and it's going to be, you know, crispy or whatever. And then there's another part of you that says, I always feel like crap when I eat that, right? But you eat it anyway. So eventually you cultivate a mindset that says, I eat food that's compatible with me. And then you have to find flavorful food that's compatible with you. Where most people go wrong, it's like, oh, I'll have the kale salad. Dude, kale tastes like crap. Kale makes you hungry. Kale is full of toxins and doesn't have enough energy to power anything.
Yeah.
It's not a very good food source. In fact, it'll make your fasts worse. Mm. And I talk about the two major toxins in kale and then why that's biologically real in the book. But it's maybe not kale. It could be something else. But eventually you're like, you know what? That looks like something that is going to nourish me. It is going to leave me full of energy. And after I eat that, I'm going to have a food high. Not like the sugar caffeine food high, but the, man, I got everything I needed. I feel so good. I'm not going to think about food for 6 or 8 hours. And you don't. And someone puts donuts in front of you, you just don't want them. Because you realize those donuts aren't compatible with me.
It's possible. Yeah. You have donuts. I could put donuts in front of you and be like, yeah, whatevs.
You can measure my salivary output like Maslow's dogs. Holy, there is nothing.
There's hope.
They're not food. Like, and it's not that I have this willpower and there's no shame or guilt or any of that stuff. It's just that when you're used to running at the power you're capable of, the Limitless movie, you know, Bulletproof, the state of high performance was the first tagline for the. It's hard to put words to having the amount of energy and focus and clarity and willpower and control and like happiness in my life. And I know that there's some things when I eat that, I'm going to enjoy it, but I'm going to pay way more than the value of the enjoyment. And so I want to feel like this all the time because this is the most precious thing on earth. It's energy. Because think about it. Okay. There's three big things that we think about for resources. We think about dollars. We think about time. And we think about energy. But most people don't think that much about energy. It's just there. It's not there. They don't manage it. So I know this because I had no energy by the time I was 30. Like I bought disability insurance and I wouldn't have hired myself. And I had the accelerator all the way to the floor and I was slowing down. I didn't know what to do. Wow. That's what motivated me to create the stuff I created.
Yeah.
But when you have no energy, if you have time, you sleep all the time. That's all you do. Okay. When you have no energy and you have money, you spend all of your money to get your energy back. And I did that. I spent all of the money I had sometimes and then some because I was desperate to feel normal, much less the way I feel now, which is a whole different level. And what you realize is that everything you do, you invest some amount of energy and it has a return on energy. Because with energy, you can make time and you can make money. But if you have no energy, time and money become useless. So you start thinking about food. All right, what's it going to do to my energy? right? And you're like, oh, that's not it. So what else would taste amazing and be satisfying and delicious and fulfilling that is going to give me more energy? And you choose that. And pretty soon you're like, I don't want the Skittles, right? Because I won't feel the energy. But what else could I do that would be really satisfying? Can I eat some high-end dark chocolate? You know, you can. And it's a much better choice.
Very nice.
And it's not about being perfect. It's about just making something that's a better decision than the one that you would have made before. And eventually you just get used to feeling, man, I don't know the right word for it. It's ephemeral.
How do you feel right now?
And okay, it's the end of the day for me. It's like 4 p.m.
Yeah.
I've been on a 90-minute podcast. I've been in management things. I had some difficult HR stuff to deal with. I've been fundraising. Wow. I feel amazing. Like I have so much energy. I had lunch a couple hours ago. It was 24 hours after my meal before that. So I had lunch yesterday. I had lunch today.
Oh, wow.
And I wasn't hungry. I didn't think about food. I'm like, I'm totally good to go. And if I hadn't had lunch, it was like, oh, my wife made it for me. It was this lamb burgers from our own lamb on our organic farm. I'm like, I'm eating that, but I wasn't hungry. I would have waited until dinner just because I had a busy day. Right? But it's the dialed in. I don't grasp for words. I don't, my mind can do whatever I want it to do. Mm-hmm. And my body feels good. My joints aren't sore the way they have been for a lot of my life. Like everything's working and it's working with so little friction that why would I gum up the works? And when you realize that you're capable of feeling that way, and by the way, try intermittent fasting. You do it the way I'm talking about, with especially with the Bulletproof stuff, you might feel it the first day. If not, you'll feel it by the end of the week. You're like, whoa, like I am clearer than I have been in a long time. I had forgotten. In fact, maybe I never knew that I could feel like that. But I'm 48 and I have more energy than I did when I was 28. And I look at my brain response time on quantitative EEG measures, P450D. Yeah. You probably know what that is.
Yeah.
I have the average brain response time for audio and visual stimulation of a 20-year-old.
What about your telomeres? How old are you in terms of your telomeres?
Well, it depends which ones you measure. And telomere measurement is a suspect science, because they're pulling blood and blood telomeres change in length all the time. So different tissues in the body have different telomere length. And the real way to get telomeres would be to basically do a muscle biopsy from different sites in the body, which is painful and no one's going to do that.
That sounds fun.
You get a very different result than if you just do a blood one. Oh. So I have seen blood ones vary by up to 20 years, taken 1 week apart. So,
oh, well, that doesn't sound too much error. Yeah, that's too much error.
Yeah, exactly. It's a lot of noise. So I've been younger and I've been as old as I am, but I don't really trust those. But I look at my arterial flexibility with pulse wave analysis. And I have the average flexible arteries of a 24-year-old. I have the grip strength of an 18-year-old. And I don't train all this stuff. Like, it's just natural, but all that's a side effect. I just want to feel freaking amazing all
the
time.
You're the bionic man.
Well, it's by choice. And this is coming back from a 300-pound like wrecked biology. But I'm going to finish this. I'm going to have another internal call for my company. I'm going to go in and it's Friday night. I'm going to make dinner with the kids. We're going to have dinner, maybe watch a movie or something, right? And I'll be an attentive, awake, alert father who's not zoned out on the couch drinking a beer. And I'm going to sleep like a rock star tonight. Last night, I got 2.5 hours of deep sleep and 2 hours of REM sleep and 7 hours of total sleep. And it's easy. This is easier than anything I've ever done before because I have so much energy. This is why I wrote Fast This Way, because, man, if half the country learned intermittent fasting and learned to not maybe listen so much to that voice in their head that says, I'm starving, I'm afraid, I need this, I need this, I need this, which all eventually drives to fear. Imagine what the world would look like. You have enough energy to take care of the people around you, not just yourself. Like I want that world. It's possible.
Well, not only that, but all the less food that we'd be eating, we could give to third world countries where people are starving, you know, in a deathly way. You know, you said someplace that you said, you know, why I'll live to be 180. Do you think you still could be, could you live to 180?
It's at least 180. I don't want to.
Dave, you're a cool cat, man. Like you don't think small, do you?
Look, here's the deal. I'm okay to die trying.
Yeah.
But we know people can do 120. In fact, a lady who's 117 just got COVID and survived. So if our current best is 120, these were people born when there were no cars. They fought World War I on horseback 20 years after they were born. I mean, it's a completely different world. There was no antibiotics, no DNA, because they couldn't spell it, because they didn't know it existed. We didn't understand anything. We couldn't share PubMed. I mean, I guess you used the Pony Express back then. I have no idea. But like, if they can do it, and we can do 50% better over the next 120 years, 140 years of life, you know what? It's because a comet hit the planet, or because we destroyed all of our topsoil with synthetic beef production, or some kind of weird thing that we do to ourselves. Otherwise, I will not be alone. There are going to be many people who aren't just, you know, hustled over or hunched over, you know, hollow shells who don't remember their own name. I'm talking working brain, working memory, enough wisdom to finally have solved some of the things that I wanted to solve in my own life and others, and enough wisdom to share and give back. Like, we need our village elders. They need to be full power, and it's happening. The tech is here. The tech is arriving every single day at an exponentially increasing rate. And I've been involved in that field for 20 years, and it's finally happening.
Man, can you imagine, like, me and you, we do a podcast when we're both 180 years old, what we would look like? You would think our chins wouldn't be down to the...
We should look about like we do now.
Dude.
I mean, we are right now, there's things like peptide signaling and microelectric things and pulsed electromagnetic, very subtle changes you can make. So we can drive collagen synthesis in skin already, right? Yeah. So we are to the point now, even David Sinclair, a friend from Harvard, it's like, for the first time, he stands up and says, we can reverse biological aging in cells. And I studied this a lot. I went around, I did all the stuff that crazy, you know, billionaires do. I have had a ton of my stem cells taken out and put into my brain and everywhere else you can think of. And what you find is that we know so much more now than we ever did. And it's so incredibly cheap. You get your DNA sequence for a couple hundred bucks that would have cost $100 million when I was starting my career. That's only in whatever, 30 years. 30 years. I'm talking about 100 years, right? So our ability to change ourselves to be the age we want to be the energy we want to be, and to be the kind people that we're actually wired in ourselves to be, it's coming, and it's better now than it's ever been. And it's hard to see that if you're tired and sick and listening to this, and you go to the doctor and he kind of sees you for 3 minutes and hands you a bottle of pills. That's not the future.
Well, I hope you're right. There's a lot of work to do. A lot of work to do in this life.
There is a lot of work to do, but man, the work is easier than ever before. Scott, we're in different countries on opposite sides of the planet, or not the planet, of the continent. We're looking at each other over video right now, recording it. Do you know what a miracle that is?
It's absolutely miraculous. So where are you right now?
I'm in Victoria, British Columbia.
Oh, okay. Yeah. No, I mean, it is absolutely miraculous. I'm wondering if we're still going to go at the same rate, you know, that we have.
We're not.
It's
exponential.
Right. So.
It's totally exponential. And my whole career in Silicon Valley has shown me this over and over, because the tech that's letting us do this is letting other people share information more quickly than ever before. You know, we're using artificial intelligence to learn things about biology that we could only dream of even 5 years ago. So it's exponentially getting faster and faster. The only question is whether, you know, evil corporations or bad people will try to, you know, prevent stuff like that from rolling out. They can't. That's why we have biohackers. Hackers find stuff. We share it.
You know, something does worry me, though, is that stuff's going to be so expensive. The only ones that are going to be, you know, 180 years old are like the billionaires, you know, and like everyone else dies. Is that the kind of world we want to live in?
Not to worry. So if you think about it, the first people to get cell phones were the billionaires, right? They spent $40,000 and took up the whole trunk of their Mercedes 300D, yeah. Right? And it was $25 a minute. And you'd see him driving down in LA, the TV producer, like, who does that guy think he is? And you can buy a cell phone for a dollar in Africa 30 years later. Okay. Yes, the billionaires will be the first people to live to 180, because they're going to spend billions of dollars to do it. And guess what they're going to do then? They're going to say, hey, I think I'd like my kids to live to 182. I have to commercialize this. And when people see that happening, if this technology does not get shared, there will be pitchforks. This is a fundamental human right.
There should be. There should be pitchforks.
Do you want to be 180 years old where everyone you know dies because you didn't share the stupid thing you figured out? No, they don't either. Some of these guys are my friends. I've met them because of Bulletproof. A lot of them use Bulletproof. Mm. I've sat down with them. They're putting hundreds of millions of dollars into research on aging. They don't want to keep it to themselves. They want to build companies out of it. They want to bring it to the world. Because frankly, a world full of people who are old and sick and dying is not the world any of us wants to live in. And if you're going to be here for 180 years, are you really going to throw that plastic wrapper in the ocean? Because you're going to eat it 100 years from now.
Mm. Yeah, no, absolutely. I completely agree. Do you think you'll live longer than Kurzweil?
Given his weird diet, probably.
I feel like there's like a competition among like the I'm going to live forever guys. Like I'm going to live more longer than you.
I'm younger than he is.
Yeah.
So the younger you are, the more years you have for the technology to catch up.
Yeah.
But the odds are pretty good there. And I actually have enormous respect for Ray Kurzweil. I mean, he's been a transformative guy in Silicon Valley.
He's a legend. Yeah, he's a legend.
Yeah, absolute legend. And I'm not sure how he's changed his diet, but his original anti-aging diet didn't fly with most of the people in the anti-aging industry that I worked with. Mm. But he's an innovator like me, right? Like I would, in fact, one of these days I'll pick his brain on my show, I'm sure. Because he's a brilliant, brilliant guy.
I'm shocked he's never been on your podcast.
You know, when he wrote his last book, he was supposed to come on and something came up and we never connected.
Was it his book Transcend?
No, it was...
Because we both have the same book titles.
It was the one before that. It was like A Girl's Name. It was actually the best written book I've ever seen to just explain to people, even to kids, like, here's how technology is coming. It was fantastic. It was like Lucy or something. I don't remember his name.
Cool. So you talk about different types of fasting in your book, and I was wondering if you could explain the 16-8 fast to people.
Sure. The 16-8 fast is the most popular intermittent fast you'll see. That means you don't eat for 16 hours, eat for 8 hours. And if you're new to fasting, you're going, what? Except here's what this means. Have dinner, have it a little bit early. In fact, eating dinner early makes you sleep better. It'll make you live longer. It's really good for you. So let's say you're done eating at 6 p.m. Okay. You got to bed at 10. That was 4 hours. You sleep for 8 hours. That was 12 hours. That's 12 hours if you wake up at 6 a.m. And by 10 a.m., that was just 16 hours. So, I mean, have dinner, in dinner by 6, have breakfast at 10. You can do this. You had a late breakfast, right?
That's have totally some black doable. Coffee when you wake I can up. Do that. I can do that.
You can. So that's a 16-8 fast. But then again, what if you just waited till lunch, right? Now you've got an 18-hour, an 18-6 fast. And that's more convenient. And what you do is you add in the three fasting hacks from the book, either at 8 a.m. or 10 a.m., whatever you want to. And one of them is black coffee. One of them is bulletproof coffee. And there's various biochemical reasons. And the other one is prebiotic fiber. All of these tell your body you're still fasting, but they give you electrons. So all of a sudden you're like, yeah, my brain works better than it did before, right? But a 16-8 fast is very achievable. And the better thing is, especially if you're metabolically unfit, I have a chapter in the book for you. You don't have to do it every day. You can do it 3 days a week and you get great benefits, but you'll probably find you want to do it every day because you feel better than when you ate breakfast. You just eat breakfast because 100 years ago, 150 years ago, when we had basically the invention of industrial production, people would go to work in the morning and they'd work 14 hours without a bathroom break. I mean, like that was that. And you didn't get a lunch break, you didn't get any break. And so they'd say the only time to eat was then, and then they'd go to bed. So eventually there were riots and whatever, and they got a lunch hour. But we started regimented eating because of industrialization. It's never been good for us. In fact, it's like this. If you had a thing, look, I go to the gas station every Tuesday and I fill up. Right now, if you didn't drive your car all week, you'd be stupid to go fill up. But you always fill up with 10 gallons. So you go there and you just pump the 10 gallons out. What do you put in the back seat? I don't know. You pump it out onto the ground, but you always pump at the same. That's what we're doing. What if you didn't eat until you were hungry? What would happen? What would happen is you get healthier. Nothing bad would happen.
It's mind-blowing. Well, just people are on autopilot. I mean, it's just, it takes a book like yours for you to be like, wait, hold up. You mean I don't have to eat that all the time. Yeah.
You might feel the need to, or you might want to eat it all the time, but then you're like, well, wait a minute. Can I eat something that's like creamy and fatty and delicious? Would that be nearly as satisfying as that, you know, low fat sugar treat? And, you know, why do I want this salty chip that I know will make me hungry in about 20 minutes? I'm going to want more.
Yeah.
Like, what if I could have something that was salty, like a fat bomb, or, you know, something that had more heft to it? That's the reason I make the collagen bars I make for Bulletproof. I'm not trying to sell those there, but I wanted to get something that I could eat on airplanes that wouldn't make me hungry again. Cause everything I eat on an airplane makes me like starving in a half hour. Like, I'd rather starve. So
I eat those
you
bars.
Know, how do you do that? Yeah. You what?
I eat those bars. I have a whole bunch. Oh yeah. Oh, yeah, I love awesome. The collagen. Thanks, I love the collagen bars. I feel like I always look younger than I am anyway, but I feel like I look even younger than I already do.
Collagen makes a difference.
I know.
It's funny. The fat.
Look at this. Look at this.
You look like a great beauty.
It's not too shabby over here, is it?
Is it a Zoom filter though?
No, there's no filter. No filter.
You look pretty good. Thanks, dude. A half-life of fat in the body. It takes 2 years to replace half the fat in your body.
Wow.
And if you go on fast this way or you try the Bulletproof thing where you're eating more grass-fed butter, eating more saturated fats, your body actually will remake all of your cell membranes, including your mitochondria. And those become better light bulbs, better power producers. Hmm. Over 2 years, you replace half the fat. But collagen takes 7 years.
Oh, wow. Right?
So if you eat some collagen every day and your body starts incorporating the building blocks of collagen into your own collagen stores, over about 7 years, half the collagen in your body is going to be replaced with properly made younger collagen.
Holy shit. That's amazing.
I've been doing it for 14 years now and I think my skin's looking pretty good.
So you're like a baby.
Pretty much.
I mean, that is incredible. So I'm going to keep up. I do have collagen every single day. So
it's a really important practice. Yeah. Every person around 100 plus years ago had collagen every day because we wouldn't throw away parts of the animal like that. We would make soup from bones and skin. We ate everything. Now we just eat the muscles and throw the rest away. You need that collagen.
So you say that some fasts are better than others. I mean, we just talked about the 16-8 one. Can you perhaps tell our listeners like one to stay away from? Do you warn against some particular?
Yeah. I warn against overfasting.
Okay.
So, it's one of my favorite fasts is called one meal a day or OMAD. It sounds, all manly. I'm going to do OMAD today.
Very high testosterone.
Right. What it means is you basically have that one meal. And so ideally, if you were to be perfect, you have it around 2 or 3 in the afternoon. And that helps you sleep way better at night. And you do that. And dinner time comes around. Oh, I would normally eat now, but I'm truly not hungry. I actually don't want food. And, you hang out and have a good evening. And you wake up and the next day, you don't want breakfast because I'm not hungry. And then lunch rolls around. I guess I could eat. So I do that sometimes. But if you don't have a metabolism that works well, that's going to totally be a stressor. It's going to overwhelm you. So fasting is like weightlifting, right? If you go to the gym every day and you lift heavy, you just get injured. You get tired and you don't put on muscle. So with fasting, I tell people start gently. You don't have to do it the same way every day. If you didn't sleep well, if you're hungover, you're having a really rough day, eat.
Are you okay?
Yeah, I've been talking all day.
Okay.
Just had to have some water. But all I say is eat. It's okay to eat. So a lot of people fall into this rigid fasting. I have to follow the rules. I'm going to fast. And it's the same as eating 3 meals a day, following the rules. Especially for women, it's really important. Like if you're just blown out today, have some breakfast, but have protein and fat. Don't have, the stack of pancakes. And once a week, make sure you eat 3 times a day. So that sort of unending, brutal, rigid fasting, it creates more biological stress than your body needs. And fasting should be a hormetic stressor that makes you stronger. And a lot of people, when they say, I have to do a 16-8 every day, women are doing great. And then it comes time for their period. And some women do great fasting during their period. But a lot of times they're already inflamed. There's already enough biological stress. And maybe that's a day when you do a 12-hour fast or a 14-hour fast, not an 18-hour fast. Mm. And just it's okay to mix it up on a daily basis. The trick is every day your stomach should be empty for at least 12 hours. And if you do that, you're going to be happy. And eventually you just get stronger and then you go longer.
I think I do that automatically. Like if I stop eating at 7 and I don't eat again until 8, I'm definitely doing that already. So that's good.
You are.
But I can go further.
Longer.
Yeah, I can go further.
No, longer is better.
No, look, I'm sold. Dave, I like at least 16. I can go 16, right? Like,
yeah.
And then
if you did 16-8, like 4 or 5 days a week, maybe on weekends, have brunch or whatever.
Yeah.
It'll transform your brain. I mean, your body starts to just replace the dim bulbs.
I am.
You've got a lot of dim bulbs, I can tell.
Is that a good thing?
I'm just messing with you.
I'm like, wait a minute, Dave.
Definitely not a dim bulb.
No, I was like, no, look, I was going to say something really kind. I was going to say I am immensely grateful to have friends like you. I really appreciate you talking to me today. I know you've been talking all day, and I really appreciate you coming to my podcast and teaching us not that, you know, that fasting is like the art. It's an art form, you know, and there's a science, absolutely. But it also feels like it's kind of this like art form that's not only about food. And I think that's a really mind-boggling sort of realization that one gets from reading your book. So thanks so much for chatting with me.
You are welcome, Scott. I'm a fan of your work, and I just had some fun on your show. You do really thought-provoking stuff, and I'm happy that we get to be friends.
Yay! Thanks, Dave. Well, happy fasting.
Well, likewise.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Psychology Podcast. If you'd like to react in some way to something you heard, I encourage you to join in on the discussion at thepsychologypodcast.com. That's thepsychologypodcast.com. Thanks for being such a great supporter of the show, and tune in next time for more on the mind, brain, behavior, and creativity.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters. With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.